Good afternoon. Pleases the court. I'm Allison Ruttenberg. I'm alternate defense counsel for Mr. Lanieri. The issue before the court is the interpretation of latches and whether it was properly applied in this case to deny Mr. Lanieri's 35C motion without reaching the merits. I realize the court did reach the merits in some cursory respect, but I respectfully submit that I was blindsided regarding that. And if the court agrees with me that the court erred in denying the motion based on latches, it should remand with instructions to the district court to allow me to supplement the 35C motion before the court reaches the merits. At that first hearing status conference we had before the court, I explained that I did not supplement the 35C motion because I was saving all of that time and expense to do so in this very complex case because of the issue of latches, that if the case was going to be dismissed because of latches, it didn't make sense for me to bill the ADC for all of the time and trouble and retain experts to reach the merits. And I never had a chance to supplement the 35C. There's various issues in that 35C I would have supplemented, and I believe it was unfair for the district court, after agreeing to do it in that manner, kind of bifurcate the proceedings to then reach the merits and not give me the chance to supplement the 35C. So I'm going to be addressing primarily the latches argument, unless the court has questions on the other aspect of it. I argued in the district court and in my opening brief that the way latches is being interpreted contradicts what this court said in Valdez and what the Colorado Supreme Court held many years ago in those older cases in interpreting latches in a civil context. That the key here, you need more than just an unreasonable delay. And for purposes of this motion, I'm conceding that waiting 14 years after the mandate issues on direct appeal to file a 35C, that that was an unreasonable delay.
Is this his first 35C?
It is. And
Ms. Ruttenberg, can I clarify what you're conceding? In your brief, I thought you were disputing that this was the unreasonable delay. You're conceding that now, that it was unreasonable?
Well, I don't think it matters either way, because what the crux of my argument is, whether it was unreasonable or not, the issue is there was no detrimental reliance by the district attorney on the delay. So that's where the government loses the latches argument. There was disputed issues of fact regarding whether it was reasonable or not. Mr. Lanieri did testify that when he was first sent to the DOC, he was sent to that North Fork Correctional Facility in Oklahoma, where they don't have a Colorado, they had no Colorado case law. They had a very cursory law library. He had no access to Colorado case law. But it's undisputed that well within the 14 years he was transferred to a Colorado facility that did have a Colorado law library. So whether it was unreasonable or reasonable, the issue here is, even if it was an unreasonable delay.
So you're no longer arguing that it was reasonable.
Right. I'm no longer contesting that finding of fact by the judge. I'm saying that even if it was an unreasonable delay, and even if the district attorney was prejudiced by the fact that Mr. Shaha died 3 years before the 35 Shehe. I'm sorry, Mr. Shehe passed away 3 years before the 35C was filed, that the district attorney did not meet the elements of latches, because everybody keeps skipping over this clause, and kind of the third element of the test was intervening reliance by and prejudice to another. Somehow that keeps getting interpreted to be either no intervening reliance or prejudice to another, and all the district courts are making the district attorney show that there was some sort of prejudice flowing by the unreasonable delay. And in this case, I don't think there's any dispute that the death of the lead trial counsel would have prejudiced the district attorney. You always have those issues in these complex cases where appellate proceedings take so long. Even if Mr. Lineri had filed his 35C on a day after the mandate issued, which was 10 years after the sentencing hearing, there's going to be some prejudice by fading memories, loss of some documents, people not remembering what happened. The rules of professional conduct were only recently amended to clarify that defense counsel in an F1 case have to retain their files indefinitely. Prior to that, many defense counsel were destroying their files after 3 or 4 years. And so in a case like this where appellate proceedings take 10 years or more, and unfortunately, that's becoming more and more common, especially in a homicide case, trial defense counsel may have already destroyed his files. That's going to cause prejudice to the district attorney and to other people when the 35C motion is filed, but that's not enough.
Ms. Ruttenberg, as you know, in the Robbins case, the Supreme Court said that a motion to dismiss a 35C motion on the basis of laches could be filed. But I don't believe the Supreme Court addressed the issue of detrimental reliance in that case. So can you tell us what you think the import of that is?
I agree. This court, in interpreting the Robbins case in People versus Valdez, came up with those three elements, where the third element is intervening reliance by and prejudice to another, which I think is the correct test. And laches is an equitable doctrine. It's similar to equitable estoppel. What you need is a change in position by the other side that's seeking to stop, in this case, the defendant.
Ms. Ruttenberg, your opposing counsel suggests that your argument seems to confuse and conflate estoppel with laches, and those are different doctrines at common law, and you're importing elements of estoppel into laches.
I think they're similar doctrines. They're clearly different doctrines. I think I characterize laches as being kind of a first cousin to equitable estoppel. It's not the same thing. It's a different type of doctrine, but it's similar to equitable estoppel in that you need this detrimental reliance, and that was made clear by this court in Valdez. And what detrimental reliance means is you rely to your detriment on something, and relying to your detriment on something means you change your position in reliance upon something. And in this case, we had a 14-year delay after the mandate issued. The district attorney needs to show not just we're prejudiced by that 14 years, but we changed our position in reliance upon the fact that no 35C motion was filed. And I gave some examples. Best example, I think, would be everybody knew that Mr. Shehe was ill and that he could pass away at a relatively young age. What if the district attorney said, okay, let's do an audit of our cases where he was lead or second chair? We still have a bunch of cases out there that have only recently come back on direct appeal or took a long time on direct appeal, and see which of those cases 35C motions have not yet been filed. And we're going to make a conscious decision. If it's been more than 5 or 6 years, we're going to rely on the fact that the defendant is waiving a 35C. We're not going to go out and talk to him. We're not going to get his records. We're not going to interview him on any potential ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
And Ms. Ruttenberg, let me question you about this interviewing defense counsel about a motion that's not been filed. What would they be asking him about? Like, is there any possible ineffective assistance you engage them, even though no one's alleged it?
Well, obviously, it's going to be difficult to interview somebody about a motion that hasn't been filed yet, but I think at a very minimum, you would want to go to him and say, look, please preserve all your records. Please do a memo to the file about your work in this case so that if you do pass away before a 35C is filed, there'll be some record of your thought process on various issues. I don't think it should come as any surprise that these various 35C issues were raised. I mean, Mr. Lineri was complaining about some of these issues for years, the jury instructions, the conflict of interest regarding the paralegal in the public defender's office, that supposedly there was a personal relationship and that paralegal was the mother of the victim in this case. You don't have to actually get a waiver of attorney-client privilege to Mr. Lineri's detriment, but I think it'd be very reasonable for the district attorney in that situation to affirmatively go to defense counsel and say, we're concerned that in this case, no 35C motion has been filed yet. under the statute of limitations hasn't expired yet. Please do a comprehensive memo to the file explaining your thought process on these various issues that might arise. Make sure your file is complete and make sure it's available in case you do pass away and then Mr. Lanieri exercises his post-conviction rights. That's just one example.
Ms. Ruttenberg, assuming that we were to agree with your argument in that regard, wouldn't it impose upon the district attorney a similar obligation to audit or interview all of the prosecution witnesses? I mean, in this case, as you know, there was a police officer who passed away, and I believe there was a CBI agent who was suffering from dementia. So wouldn't that policy of interviewing apply to them also?
If it was foreseeable that that witness would, obviously if a witness suddenly develops dementia, that's not foreseeable. But if the district attorney is on notice and they're affirmatively changing their position upon reliance that no 35C motion has been filed, in other words, we don't have to do anything because no 35C motion has been filed. We don't have to go to the, therefore we don't have to go to the police and ask them to preserve their records. We don't have to preserve our own records. We can just rely on the fact that no 35C has been filed. We don't have to worry about that. Instead, what they're doing is just saying, well, we're just prejudiced by the mere passage of time, which isn't enough for detrimental reliance. There has to be some sort of affirmative change in position in reliance upon the other side's conduct, similar to what happens in equitable and promissory estoppel.
For 99.44% of these cases, they have the transcripts from the first trial. They have a testimony of all these people. It can be used again, and I don't know how you challenge. You can challenge ineffective assistance. I appreciate that's a separate category of claims. But with respect to everybody else, they've got a full record of what these people had to say and cross-examine.
Well, in this case, what the district court found for the detrimental reliance or for the prejudice was merely the fact that trial defense counsel was deceased and they couldn't talk to them. Where's the change in position in reliance upon the fact that the defendant never filed a 35C motion? If it's correct that they had all the records anyway, such as the transcripts and witness interviews, and the district attorney never destroyed their files, the police department never destroyed their files, in other cases where latches has been an issue, there's been some affirmative destruction of the files by the police department. That didn't happen in this case, so that's an alternative way where the district court erred. There was no prejudice. Just saying that defense counsel isn't available anymore isn't enough to establish prejudice when, as you correctly pointed out, we have all the transcripts, we have his complete file, we have his second chair co-counsel, who's now the head of the public defender's office in Weld County. He's alive and well and able to be interviewed about all of these issues. And
but Ms. Ruttenberg, as I understand your open brief and your reply brief, you're not challenging the fact or the notion that the prosecution was prejudiced here. You're saying that's not enough, but you're not challenging that fact is true, correct?
True. What I'm saying now in response to Judge Roy's question, that even if it was true, that's still not enough to show prejudice if it's correct that we have a complete record. Nothing was destroyed, which is what so often happens in these other cases. After 5 or 6 years, some police departments have a policy of affirmatively destroying the records 5 years after the mandate issues, or even 3 years after the mandate issues after a direct appeal. That didn't happen in this case. There was no record of that happening here. I only have a minute left. I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal if there's no other questions.
Right. That's fine. Thanks, Ms. Ruttenberg.
May it please the court, Ajay Diazdi representing the people in this case. Your Honors, the issue before the court is very narrow and specific. The issue is whether latches requires proof of detrimental reliance. And I think Robbins' case is dispositive of the issue. In that case, the Supreme Court applied latches and reached the conclusion that In that case, the prosecution had established prejudice and met and satisfied the requirement of laches by showing that it was prejudiced. The court's statement is that the people adequately demonstrated prejudice in that the only witness who could respond to Robbins' claims is now deceased. That's all that was needed for the prosecution to prove that laches applied and the prosecution suffered prejudice because of the delay caused by the defendant.
So, counsel, if in order to accept your position, do we have to disagree with the Valdez decision?
I don't think Valdez is disagreement with Robbins.
Well, it has that language that your opposing counsel has noted, that there has to be intervening reliance by the prosecution. Do you think that was stray language? We didn't need it?
At least the holding of the case, the conclusion is not based on any notions of detrimental reliance, regardless of that language. But here we have a clear application of the concept of the principle by the Supreme Court, and I think this court is bound by that decision.
The clock is running.
Excuse me.
The clock was not running.
It was just pointed out by Judge Roy that the clock didn't start when you began your argument. So
that would be fine, Your Honor, because I'm ready actually to stop at this point. Unless the court has any questions, I think the Robbins case is dispositive of the issue, regardless of any policy arguments that were presented here. We are bound by the way the Supreme Court interpreted laches and applied it in that case. All that was required of the prosecution to establish is that it was prejudiced. And here, the death of a witness was cited as being adequate. And of course, in the present case, we have the defense counsel who was deceased and also two witnesses who were not available, one because of death and one because of dementia.
Do you want to address briefly, in light of the testimony and the record, apparently that Mr. Lanieri didn't have access to legal references, statutes, cases from Colorado during a significant portion of his incarceration, time in Oklahoma and Minnesota, and so forth, on the issue of whether the delay was unconscionable?
First of all, Your Honor, counsel conceded that issue is not contested anymore. Secondly, the district court addressed that in its opinion, citing that defendant still had sufficient time to access legal sources and rejected that claim. The finding of the fact by the district court, I think, is supported by the record.
Is that really what the court found in his order? When I'm looking at his order, he found that lack of legal assistance doesn't demonstrate justifiable excuse or excusable neglect. It doesn't seem like he's mentioning the law library issue. It seems like he's talking about not having an attorney.
I think there's other part of the opinion that makes a reference to the fact that he could have started it earlier, not waiting even for the mandate to be issued. So the court was pointing to the fact that there was plenty of time for the defendant to do whatever investigation or research that was required and did not do it.
Well, I guess there's a different question. There's a question of time to do it and opportunities and resources. And so, assuming he had the time, did he have the legal resources, such as a sufficiently adequate law library? And I guess I'm not seeing a lot in the trial court's order addressing that law library point.
To some extent, perhaps because the issue itself was not the main issue that was being challenged. So the court may not have addressed it if it had been the main issue before the court, but the prejudice element was the one, and the court addressed that more extensively. And besides, the court considered the merits of the claim and addressed and concluded that the claims lacked merit based on the record available before the court, because some of those claims had been raised and resolved actually in the direct appeal, as the opinion points out, and some of them would have been precluded under 35C because they could have been raised on appeal and they hadn't. So even based on the record, even though we are not getting into that because of counsel's objection to the court's making those findings, but Based on those, the court determined that even on the merits basis, the claims were not meritorious.
Mr. Yazdi, to return to the issue of detrimental reliance that Ms. Ruttenberg was arguing, and referring to Judge Navarro's question about the Valdez case, do you know where in the Valdez, or what the Valdez division relied on in citing detrimental reliance as a factor?
I know that Valdez actually cited Robbins as authority for the three elements of the, I mean, discussing latches in general, but I don't remember specifically for that language if there is a citation. I can quickly...
Well, let me ask you this then. Are you aware of...
Cullen versus Phillips, I'm sorry.
Okay, and have you reviewed Cullen v. Phillips?
I actually included that, and it is... The word detrimental reliance, of course, I don't think is found in Collins versus Phillips either. And I would even go further back to the case that Ms. Rodenberg cites for the authority that we need detrimental reliance, which is Norman versus Boyer back in 1943. That is the main case that counsel relies on. However, even in that case, the language is that such changes have taken place in the position of the parties, not detrimental reliance, but just changes. So that language does not support the argument that before Robbins, the language required detrimental reliance, and for some reason, Robbins used sloppy language, and then following, you know, cases that did not use the detrimental language because of Robbins. So I think based on Robbins, detrimental reliance is not an element of latches. Previous cases seem to support that. What intervening language means is not clarified either in Valdez or in Robbins, is not even used.
Well, go ahead. I mean, getting back to Cullen versus Phillips, which you do talk about in your brief, you have a quotation which says, quote, the prejudice may include a detrimental change of position by the defendant.
May include.
Right. So you're saying that that's a possible source, or that would be sufficient to show prejudice, but it's not necessary.
Exactly.
Is that your point?
Okay. Exactly. It's not a required element. It is another way of describing possible prejudice.
Thank you.
Unless the court has any questions, I ask the court to affirm the district court's order.
Thank you, Mr. Yazdi.
Thank you.
Respectfully, I interpret the language in Norman v. Boyer differently. Quote, changes have taken place in the position of the parties relative to the subject matter of the litigation, as to render it inequitable to permit the enforcement of rights concerning which otherwise there might be no difficulty, unquote, means detrimental reliance, means a change in position in reliance upon whatever the situation is, in this case, the delay. I don't see any other way to interpret that, because otherwise, I think what the Attorney General is trying to suggest is the mere death of trial counsel is a sufficient enough change to have taken place in a position of the parties so as to allow the latches doctrine. And if this court were to allow that, trial counsel unfortunately die. Sometimes they die before even the direct appeal is over, especially if the direct appeal takes a very long time. Very soon, and I made this argument in the opening brief, we're going to have a situation where trial counsel passes away before the mandate even issues, and then a district attorney is going to try to raise latches and say, you're too late because now we're prejudiced by the inability to interview trial counsel because all we have to show is an unreasonable delay coupled with the death of a witness. And here, you sat on your rights for 10 years while this direct appeal was proceeding. You could have filed your 35C motion and asked for a limited remand as soon as you were made aware of the illness of your trial counsel. And I think I'm out of time.
Thank you, Ms. Ruttenberg. And thank you, Mr. Yazdi. We appreciate both of your excellent arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.